Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.
Welcome back to the dialogue with Diwa de Boer on Reality Check Radio, where we discuss politics, power, and culture. You can text us your thoughts on 2057 or email your questions to inbox@realitycheck.radio. We are joined now by Jim Penman, who you may know as the CEO of Jim's Group, a very successful franchise with Jim's Mowing and Jim's Cleaning. You've undoubtedly seen them around New Zealand. He also holds a PhD in history and currently does research in biochemistry and epigenetics. He's authored books on business, entrepreneurship, and biohistory. So welcome to the show, Jim.
Good to be here.
So is there any other background on yourself that you'd like to give, maybe on the franchise that you started, and why did you pick Mowing Lawns, of all things, as a business?
Well, I intended to be an academic. That was my idea. I developed these very radical ideas, basically, in my 20s. And arriving from history, but then coming to the conclusion that the basic patterns behind history could be understood better in terms of biology and those kinds of things. So then I came to the end of my PhD and found I had absolutely no prospect of an academic career of any kind, given my weird take on the way the world works. So I just turned my part-time lawn mowing business as a student support into a full-time job. And 7 years later, in 1999, I franchised it without much expectation. I thought I maybe have 100 franchises one day. Now, closing on 6,000.
Wow, 6,000. And across how many countries is that? Is that just Australia, New Zealand, or is it all over the world?
There's a small outlet in Canada, apart from that. We've got some interest in the US market, so that may be happening, but...
So let's talk about the more interesting thing then. If mowing lawns was just the side gig, what's the main thing? What did you mentioned your PhD that you did in history. What kind of research have you done in the decade since then? And could you tell us a little bit about your latest book, Biohistory, The Decline and Fall of the West?
Well, it's basically the idea that civilization is made possible by a certain kind of character. It's a character that's hardworking, good at routine, relates well to the market, relates well to larger states, the rule of law, these kind of things. And that character is actually, it's based in biological terms on food restriction. Animals that are food restricted tended to act like that. And what we do in human societies, we create cultural technologies largely encased in religions, things like heterosexual behavior, monogamy, those kinds of areas which have a similar effect of food restriction on our character. And that's what makes civilization possible. As we develop these very advanced technologies, our bodies act as if they're food restricted, even if they're not, and that makes civilization possible. Now, what's happening is that the extreme wealth of modern societies and urbanization is just destroying that. It's just too strong for the forces of these cultural technologies to beat. So religions and basically the values behind them are getting knocked down. And that's causing more and more problems, particularly things like the declining birth rate, for example. We're now well below break-even level. Most of the world is, and it's dropping all the time. You know, in East Asia, it's down to like South Korea, 0.7, about one-third, 0.7 children per woman, which is about one-third of what placement level. So it's become really catastrophic. People are starting to worry about it. The point of it is, what we're doing is looking to develop treatments that can reverse this trend, that can help people to be not only to want to have more children, but to be more successful occupationally, to be better citizens, to be better partners, to get off things like drug addiction, which is an increasing plague across so many countries. If we can restore this food restriction kind of character, which would have many, many advantages, then we could actually reverse the declines that's happening to our society.
And so this food restriction, when it's in religious terms, you're sort of describing it as basically self-denial. People are self-restrained. Is that the way that it's built society and built the civilization that we have? And when you do experiments, then what do you test this on? How do you test the effects that, say, food restriction would have on animals like lab rats?
Well, yes. What happens is things like if you stop somebody, an adolescent having free sexual behavior to the extent that you can, that will put this through in spades, because what happens in adolescence is very, very important. But anything like hard work or even ritual laws, like Jewish ritual laws, are classic examples. Does this in spades, which is why Orthodox Jews tend to resist these trends quite well. What we do with animals is we use an animal model of actual food restriction itself, which you can't do on humans. So our main model is with rats, we restrict their food 25% below what they like, which is quite mild. It's like being on a healthy diet. It's not harmful to them. In fact, they tend to live longer, and in many ways, they're psychologically healthier. But when we do this, we look at the changes in their body. We look at changes to the brain. We're particularly looking at the epigenetics, the way that it turns certain genes on or off. And once we understand that, we can start to develop treatments, which we're working on very strongly to have the same effect.
And these treatments, would they be basically medication that people would take, or are there other forms of treatment that you'd be looking at?
We're looking at pheromones as one thing. We all give odors. We know, for example, that if you have animals, rats that are food restricted, and you give their bedding to other rats who aren't food restricted, they act as if they are. It also goes cross-generationally. So if you food restrict fathers, for example, male rats, and they impregnate a female, and then the father has nothing to do with the offspring ever again, the offspring act as if they're food restricted. So it goes down the generations as well. So pheromones is one way of doing it. We're in the process of testing tens of thousands of different drugs in cell cultures to see what has the epigenetic effect we're after. And then there's treatments like CRISPR that you may have heard of. Now, CRISPR is a system that's used to target certain genes. You can go in and you can cut genes and then use it to try and... It's got the potential for curing all sorts of genetic ailments. Well, CRISPR can also target the epigenome. It can turn genes on or off. So we can look at... And that's getting close to a feasible technology. The biggest problem with CRISPR is that the targeting mechanism isn't yet quite precise enough. So the problem is if you go and change one area of the epigenome, it might change other areas as too and have effects you don't want. So we've got to actually get the targeting right. But that's probably within the next year or so that should be achievable. And then you can actually say, okay, these are the effects you want. Let's go and change it. And then what you'd probably do is you'd use it as a medical thing. Like drug addiction is one obvious target, because it should actually be a very, very effective way of taking away the need for drugs, because it'll make people think more long-term.
You've mentioned epigenetics a few times, so could you describe it in very simple terms if somebody doesn't know? What's epigenetics? What's its relation to genetics and other parts of human behavior?
Imagine DNA, the genes, as a series of tiny little taps. That's how they work. They spit out proteins, and the proteins could be RNA, messenger RNA, all kinds of things. They go and do things. They go and they do something to another gene, or they do something to the body, or they do something to the cell. They do all kinds of things. That's how DNA works. In the body, epigenetics changes a lot how your genes function in different parts of your body. So, for example, your DNA is the same in every cell of your body, but in the brain, it's got a very different effect than it does, say, in the liver. Or in the skin. And that's because certain genes are turned on or off to actually make certain kinds of organs and parts of the body. So what epigenetics does is go in and it plugs the genes. It's like a tap. If you can imagine a little tap with a protein spurting out, you take like a methyl group, which is a very typical form, and you put it on top of that, and then the tap stops working or it dies down to some extent. So what you're doing is you're changing the way genes function. And as I said, the gross function is things like, you know, deciding whether a gene's going to code for brain cells or skin or for liver or for heart. But it can also do things like change character. So there's certain influences in your background, for example, that cause certain genes to be turned on, which is not very beneficial to you. And that's causing you to be, say, a drug addict. Well, we go in and we just adjust that. I turn this one down, turn that one up. And suddenly that person doesn't need to take drugs anymore because they become happy and healthy.
And so this is quite different then to, say, both the nature and nurture explanations that people might usually give, either to say, no, this behavior is genetically baked in. People are just just born this way and genetically predisposed to certain behavior, or other people would say, I know this is, it's all nurture, the way they were raised. They were raised in a economically deprived situation, or their parents were terrible, and that's why they behave in this way. Is epigenetics sort of, is a different way of explaining it, or does it lean into that, into nature and nurture?
Look, genes do matter, but when you look at differences between societies, for example, you know, why some countries are wealthy and others poor, some are violent, others peaceful, humans, genetically speaking, are extremely, we're extremely alike each other. There's less variety of genes in the whole human race than there is in chimpanzees in a few kilometers of rainforest in Africa. So we're very, very similar genetically. There are differences between individuals in various ways, which does impact things. But we are hugely influenced by the environment. And that is not just the environment of your own upbringing. Like, it could be because you had a terrible childhood, for example, and you were abused, or you were neglected, or somebody was raped. All kinds of terrible things happen to children. That has an effect on their epigenome, which at the moment is relatively permanent. But it's also the way your parents and your grandparents and even your grandparents, because these epigenetic messages come down through the generations. So It's a huge part of who we are and why we're well and why we're happy and how we work and all things is the main thing we look at is epigenetics.
So when people use a term, and I tend to find more kind of left-wing or woke people use the term intergenerational trauma, is it you're just saying that's a real thing, that intergenerational trauma does actually affect people based on what happened to their parents and their grandparents and so on?
Yeah, absolutely it does. And an intergenerational quality too. Really good things can come from your parents and your grandparents. For example, as I said earlier, sexual activity is generally harmful for success in our society. But if your parents or your grandparents didn't indulge in it, you've got the advantage of that. So it can be very, very positive as well.
Now, the subtitle of your book, The Decline and Fall of the West, and we've talked a bit about religion and how it impacts people's behavior. Is the decline and fall of the West then simply the decline and fall of Christianity?
The decline of Christianity, and also I'd say Judaism and other faiths too, is partly a result and partly a cause. It's like a spiral that keeps on going. Because you get this immense pressure from wealth and urbanization, it causes this change in character, which causes people to be less likely to be, you know, religiously active, for example. And because they do that, their behavior changes, and that accelerates the change. So yes, it's cause and effect.
And so you're really sort of saying that abundance and excess lead to decline. And are these cycles then inevitable and inescapable? Or is that what your research is sort of trying to do? How do you escape the cycle of inevitable decline?
Well, in normal terms, they are. Because, look, people have this idea that you can sort of have a educational campaign to try and restore traditional values. And, of course, people are trying that all the time. But the problem is it doesn't really work very well. Like Putin in Russia, for example. I mean, he's a nasty, aggressive tyrant. But in one sense, he's completely correct. If you could restore traditional Orthodox Christianity to Russia, it would rejuvenate the nation. The problem is you can't do it. He's got all the power. He wants control of the media, control of the police, everything. He's a dictator. But he can't change this. Well, look at what the Chinese are doing. They had a one-child policy. And then they said, well, this is causing problems. Oops, let's stop that. Okay, you're going to have two children now. Oh, now you can have three children. You can have as many children as you like. And as they've done that, the birth rate's gone down from one-child policy to two, to as many as you like. The birth rate declined at every step of the way. The Chinese government has all this power, all this influence, all this media control, and they can't do anything about it. And people are panicking. Now, the big difference in today's world is that once we understand the science, we can actually change all this, and it would be really simple to do. This is not complicated. This is something like a vaccination program. Hey, you've got a problem with drug addiction, alcoholism, obesity, all these things which relate to, you know, too much short-term thinking. Okay, here's a pill, or here's an injection. Take it, and you cure it. And people say, oh, wow. Suddenly this person is successful and they're studying and they're becoming great parents and they're having wonderful families and their anxiety is going down and their life's turned around. This is bad. So people want to use it. If we can develop this treatment, and I'm confident we will within a few years, it will become very, very, very popular because the benefits are massive. It's actually, look, you talk about slow life history strategy. This is what we're talking about in biological terms. It's the kind of thing that says to an animal, you're in a limited food environment, so therefore spend a lot of time looking after your kids. Work hard to gather food, even when you're not particularly hungry. Look after your mate, these kind of things. These are strategies that animals use to cope with food restriction. Well, they can actually use the same kind of temperament to better navigate and be more successful within our current society.
I'm thinking of an outlier, perhaps, to the example that you've cited. Often Hungary comes up as an example of a country that's made some progress in reversing the birth rate, is you know, having some positive effect in trying to re-traditionalize their country. Are they just an outlier? Is it just temporary? What are your views on you know, what Hungary is trying to do compared to, say, what China and Russia are sort of
doing? I think they have the right idea, but it's not going to work. But the point of it is, you look at any intervention you like to mention. Now, there's restoration of religion. Romania, at one stage, just tried to say you can't have abortions and you can't do this. And they outlawed contraception. And you had all these unwanted children who had terrible lives in orphanages. You can't make people have children if they don't really want them. That's the problem. So it's had a very limited effect. There's other effects too, like if you make childcare more accessible and you do other things, you can nudge the dial a bit, but not in Hungary or anywhere else. Have you got a situation where we've even reached any intervention that's gone even close to closing the gap? 2.1 children per woman is replacement level. And we haven't got anywhere close. Even the Nordics are supposed to be better at that, and they're still going down. The only Western country that's been successful in maintaining the birth rate is Israel. Israel has done very, very well. But what have you got there? You've got a very big and growing contingent of ultra-Orthodox, which have this in spades. Then you have Muslims who tend to have more children too. You know, God bless them. That's good for them. And that kind of influence spread throughout society. Because one of the problems is when you have more people having fewer and fewer children, it becomes a social norm. So somebody who might want to have a larger family, so pretend, oh, you're going to get married, you're going to have children in your 20s, what's wrong with you? Are you some sort of a retard? What, you know, you don't care about your wife's success? I mean, they look down on them. And I can see these pressures even on my own children. You're not supposed to have children these days because it's not the norm. Now, in a society like Israel, they're a lot more family-friendly. The neighborhoods are more family-friendly. There are a lot of parents around who've got them. They gather, they go together. They walk to school alone, this kind of thing. They're not so helicopter parented.
Yeah, I can see some of this in religious communities in you know, my own country here. And if I go to church, all the young families there, everyone has kids, and that's encouraged and how we live our lives. But then as soon as you go outside of that community, you know, so you basically end up with very few people who you'd be friends with outside of that those circles who would have children or get married, because the pressures are completely different, right? And people talk about having kids and getting married in a completely different way. And a lot of that is just, as you said, just a social pressure, depending on who your family are and who your community is.
A lot of these things sort of, they feed on each other. There's a change in temperament, which causes a change in behavior, which puts pressure on people, social pressure to be like moving in that direction. There's a really wonderful book I've just finished called Family Unfriendly by, I think it's Timothy Carney, which is a fantastic book talking about the way these pressures work and the way people resist them and get on. See, one of the problems in the modern world is that we've got this psychological change which elevates certain kinds of values and behavior, like individualism, extreme individualism. You know, the whole purpose of life is for me to be fulfilled as a person and grow as a person, as an individual. And also this obsession with success. You know, you've got to go to the best university, you've got to study hard, you've got to go to the best university, you've got to be this and this. I mean, God forbid you end up something like a carpenter or a teacher or something. You've got to be successful. But, you know, why? Why is it better to be a corporate lawyer or a tax accountant than this to be a teacher or a carpenter or a gardener? Why? It doesn't necessarily make you any happier. Past about median income, wealth has very little impact on personal happiness. So why are we so obsessed with it to the extent that we don't even have children because we make their lives a hell and pull them full of anxiety and this pressure to achieve and taking them from one tutorial to one event or other to try and get them to be aces in the football team or whatever they're playing, always is drive for success. And the more parents drive kids, and the more helicoptering is, the less they want to have kids because it takes all the joy out of life. And the more anxious and the more feeble-minded and the kids are, it's a terrible, terrible spiral. And why would you want to have children when you make raising them up? It's an agony. But if you look at groups like, say, the Amish in America, as a typical example, these are people who have typical families, seven kids, and they have an ultra-communal lifestyle. They do not have the thing about status. People are very much the same. They dress the same. They have far less loneliness than we do. They're happier. All the measures show they're less stressed. Now, by the standards of the world, these people are not economically successful. They don't have massive incomes. They're mostly either farmers or tradesmen. They don't go past about year 9 in school, I think. But they're very successful people, and they're on the whole, their society is working phenomenally well. Why isn't that a model for us? I would much rather my children were like that than if they were successful but had neurotic, misplaced kids or none at all.
So especially with the Amish as an example, then we get back to basically technology, industrialization causing big changes in society. And so technology really then drives the negative effects of what's causing the decline and the fall.
Yeah.
Is largely caused by technology then. So do you believe then that technology can help us solve this, that we can jump past the decline, the fall, with more technology?
Absolutely. Yes.
And you don't see this as potentially a negative or the there being a dystopian outcome, trying to reach a utopia. Say many of the tech elite are doing a lot of research into altering humanity, altering the genome, looking at what's called transhumanism and moving past the what it's like to be human. Do you believe that's a risk, something that could be good, or do you don't really see that people pursuing that really people want to just be more human, as it were, as you've described? If people could solve some of their ailments and their failings, that they would rather be happy humans, almost like the Amish, but with technology.
Well, technology can be either good or bad. It depends. I mean, technology can cure cancer. Technology can develop a disease that could wipe out the human race. I mean, it's how you use it. There are some aspects of technology which are fantastic. I mean, it's great that we can cure disease, that we've got vaccination systems and so forth, that our children no longer die. I mean, that's the most appalling thing. Imagine half your children dying before the age of 5, which was normal in the past. How terrible it is. How wonderful modern dentistry is. And frankly, mobile phones, they can be dreadful in terms of social media. They have really, really, really bad effects on psychology, especially for teenagers. Wonderful book, The Anxious Generation. Really should read that one too, about how mobile phones are so harmful and they're taking it away from relationships and they're building their sense of loneliness. But a mobile phone can also give you a talking book, which can teach you how to live better and more happily. You can listen to something like Family or Unfriendly or Anxious Generation. You can listen to wonderful, wonderful books. You can look things up in Google. It's a fantastic source of information about how the world works. So, look, the tech people, I think they're completely off the planet. I don't think they understand what's going on at all in terms of the damage that's been happening. They see certain dangers like AI, for example, which is potentially a danger, but you don't see the greater danger of what's destroying our society from the inside. But technology is also the answer. This is for the first time in human history we've got an answer. Look, people in the Roman Empire and the late Republic understood what was happening to society. They could see the decline of character. They talk about it. And the same thing in Han China, for example, at a similar period. And the same thing in Ptolemaic Egypt. People could see this change of character and they sort of knew what was going wrong, but they couldn't stop it. But we can. Because of the incredible advances in the biological sciences, which to me is the greatest of technology advance of all, we can understand what's going on and we can change our characters in a way that we want to change them. And it's purely something people want to do. No government should ever enforce such a thing on people, but we can change and technology makes this possible. That's the excitement of it. And I'm very optimistic we will achieve this.
Now, getting back to birth rates quickly, do you believe that negative birth rates will lead to the collapse of society, like that societies need positive birth rates to maintain and to grow, or will advanced, technologically advanced societies sort of be able to adapt to having a lower birth rate and a shrinking population? Or is that just, you know, even with technology, that that's still the end? There's no way to come back from that.
Look, the declining birth rate in itself creates problems because, for example, you get less and less working age people looking after more and more elderly. I mean, who's going to be the nurses and do everything for them when they can no longer work? But the birth rate is not the major problem. It's the character change that's causing the birth rate change, which is causing other things. See, one of the mysteries of the modern world, from a point of an economist's point of view, because they only think in terms of money and systems, is that we have these amazing advances in technology, particularly computers and stuff, but our productivity is not going up. And the reason it's not going up is because the character of the population is declining and people are becoming less capable with time. It's so obvious when you look at it. You know, I had a company that made boots, Blundstones, and they had a factory in Tasmania, and they shipped it off. They shifted production to Thailand decades ago. And I asked them why they did that. And it was a matter of cost. And he said, well, that was a factor, but the main factor, we just couldn't find the great workers we used to have. They just retired. And the younger workers just aren't as good at doing this kind of stuff too. So there's a decay in character, which is causing the decline of birth rate. And that's the fundamental cause.
And like you mentioned with the other empires, the Roman Empire, you know, they saw that decline in character, and we can see the decline in character here too. Everyone talks about it, like you say. But is previously what happened then with these empires when they fell, that you sort of have effectively a genetic sifting where this behavior was had to sort of be removed from the gene pool in a time of scarcity, and character had sort of rebuilt itself, you know, through hardship. And your solution then, through biohistory, through epigenetics, is that we can fix people's character without going through that period of time where you have to basically remove all of the bad character from the gene pool.
Yeah, except I wouldn't say it's genetic at all. It's epigenetic. Mm-hmm. There's no difference fundamentally between, look, intelligence makes a difference. If you're smarter, it's a little bit easier if you're accused to succeed in school and stuff. But if you have a look at societies that are being, like, look at Athens in the Golden Age, or Greece in the Golden Age, and it's the late 5th, early 4th century BC. Now, you had this incredible explosion of creativity that's never been seen before or since. Now, this is history, philosophy, drama, architecture. All these areas saw phenomenal changes, which we're still living in the shadow of that magnificent period. And we're not talking about a few tens of thousands of free men. That's all. Now, what caused that? Because if you look 100 years earlier, nothing. If you look 100 years later, stuff all, very little going on. But why in that period? That's not a genetic change. It's an epigenetic change. And when empires collapse, it's not because there's a genetic deterioration. It's because there's an epigenetic change. And we can reverse that. That's the big, big promise of the modern world. We can reverse the epigenetic decay. And we can help individuals and societies to flourish.
So as a religious person, I would say that, you know, the belief in God and morality and faith and morality really are what should drive the greatness of a society. Is the danger, I guess, of your solutions to say, well, we don't really need religion? Is that sort of am I taking the right thing away from what you're saying to say, well, we can just use technology to improve people's character, and then religion is actually not important in that sense?
Well, religion is important, but religion needs help. I mean, you've not noticed, I'm sure, that the church attendance is dropping like a stone. It's going down and down and down and down. What's driving that? Changing the population. It's like, okay, you've got an avalanche coming down a hill, and you know that if you could throw enough snow on that to plug the avalanche, it would stop it. So you pick up a snowball and you start throwing snowballs at it. Well, it's the right idea, but it's not enough. You've actually got to have more. And what would actually happen if you developed, we call them seed promoters, things that this civilization kind of character thing that we're trying to get back. If you could produce a powerful enough seed promoters, what you would get is a revival of religion in a stage that people haven't seen for maybe a century or more. People would be brought back to faith, because once their character changes, they would turn to God. And then by turning to God, they would start acting in ways that would further strengthen and reinforce this character. So religion is crucial. Religion is part of it. I personally am a very strong, committed Christian. I'm a churchgoer, and that's one reason I have 10 kids, is that character that I believe in that kind of stuff, and I try and act in that sort of way. Like, for example, it's just not possible for me to have an affair or do porn or my church strongly encouraged me to getting involved in cocaine or other things too. So church teachings are very helpful to maintain this kind of character. We want to get on side and help God to do the work that needs to be done, if you can look at it from a Christian or, doesn't matter, Jewish, Muslim point of view.
I think you just made me think of a program that we have in New Zealand prisons that does quite well called Man Up, that's run by a pastor by the name of Brian Tamaki, and he comes on RCR. He's a regular guest, but it's considered to be a very successful program in getting men out of crime. And a large part of it is, as you mentioned, character is about character and religion, really, are the main elements of that program in getting people out of a life of generational crime. So that's a fascinating thing there. And I saw, you just made me think of a number that I saw recently with Oxford University, where they said something like there are attendees at Oxford University are 2 to 3 times more likely to attend church than the general population. Because like you said, church attendance has plummeted drastically. So there seems to, at least from anecdotes that I have, seems to be a very direct relation between those things, as you've mentioned.
Yeah, we need God. I mean, speaking as a Christian, that's the way I'd put it. I would say, in a sense, the way I would look upon the Bible is the Bible's the maker's manual. God made us. He understands the way we work. If we follow his directions as in the Bible, we'll actually have a much better life as individuals, as family members, and in terms of society. I fully recognize that. It's cultural technologies of religion that have actually driven the modern world. We haven't succeeded despite it, but because of it. And as you develop more powerful technologies, so has grown higher. But unfortunately, because we've been so successful with that technology, we've become so wealthy that it's undermining the basis of what made us a great people. And that's the sadness. And that's where science can help religion. And I believe my own point of view is I'm doing God's work. It is the mission that he has sent me to do. And that is what my life is about, fundamentally, to reverse this decline.
Well, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. And I'm glad to hear that positive view that you have, that we can reverse the decline and the fall. And yeah, it's a bit tough if you say to people, well, the problem is we're too wealthy and we're too indulgent, too much abundance, too much excess. And the solution is that we need decline, basically. You know, that's not a positive thing to hear at all. And I'm glad that you are working on ways around that, and very fascinating work that you've been doing. I would like to study it some more. I feel like I don't understand the half of it, but definitely having this conversation with you has been very, very helpful.
Yeah, great. I'm always happy to answer any questions. I'm very easy to contact too. People can go through biohistory.org, which is the website. It's got some little videos on there which explains the system, and they can contact me through that.
Well, thank you very much. And that was Dr. Jim Penman joining us from Australia, and the CEO of Jim's franchise. Thank you very much. And I do hope we'll speak again in the future.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. Do you like what you're listening to, or dislike what you're listening to? Either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We'd love to hear from you, so connect with us today.